Your reading is from Soul Repair, Recovering from Moral Injury After War, by Reverend Dr. Rita Nakashima Brock and Reverend Dr. Gabriella Latini. After World War II, the good war, the country cheered battle-weary troops, gave them parades, and welcomed them home with open arms. After Vietnam, the bad war, most people turned their backs, called the troops baby killers, or just went on with their lives as if it hadn't happened, as if it had not dominated national attention for years. The reactions to troops returning from Iraq have been mixed. Thank you for serving, some local parades, but mostly silence. Silence, perhaps, because such a small proportion of the population is serving in the military, or because people have mostly been going on with their lives all along the way, ignoring the wars. These are all ways the public disposes of war and attempts to leave it behind. The silence was encouraged by the media blackout on the images of dead soldiers and their coffins arriving home. While the administration explained the blackout as a form of respect for fallen soldiers, it functioned to hide the costs and consequences of war from public consciousness.
March 21st, 2010, at Riverside Church in New York City, about 50 co-sponsors, 80 commissioners, and 14 testifiers or experts gathered for a truth commission on conscience in war. These people gathered because they recognized that there was something deeper going on than just PTSD or the normal things that you might hear about in the news, but that people returning from war were recovering, trying to find a way to be within society and dealing with far larger issues than anyone ever really understood. As time went on, they began to see that what was happening was a form of moral injury, far beyond just an emotional awareness or response to trauma. This actually was a form of ethical quandary, of wondering if one did the right thing, if one was still a good person after a war. Rita Brock writes, "We cannot imagine spiritual fitness without moral conscience. In religious and moral traditions, moral conscience defines soul not just for the individual, but for the entire community. Such conscience is grounded in empathy and compassion for others, and the capacity to recognize what is good and to know when something is profoundly wrong. That so many veterans manage to hold on to moral conscience in the face of so much pressure to suppress it and suffer to the point of suicide rather than abandon their souls is testimony to the resilience of conscience and to their basic goodness." So what is moral injury? What is this we're speaking of? B.T. Litz in the Clinical Psychology Review, in an article titled "Moral Injury and Moral Repair in War Veterans," writes, "Moral injury is disruption in an individual's confidence and expectations about their own moral behaviors or others' capacity to behave in a just and ethical manner. This is not the same as PTSD. PTSD is a fear-victim reaction to extreme conditions that damage the amygdala and hippocampus in the brain. Literally, it makes it impossible for a person to remember the actual events, but puts them instantly in an emotional space. So that a person may remember the sounds of an ambulance, but never the car that hit them. It exists within the limbic brain, the base of our spinal cord and our brain meet. Moral injury requires a healthy prefrontal cortex, where empathy and moral thinking can occur. In this scenario, we're talking about a healthy brain trying to deal with the realities of what one has faced. And despite improvement in PTSD care, we notice that suicide rates are still high, particularly in Iraq and Afghan war veterans. So though we understand PTSD, it does not seem to resolve all of the things that veterans face upon return home. And to be clear, not all veterans face these things. But those who do face it oftentimes in a vacuum and without the support of their own communities. There are some key things we know cause moral injury in war. And for those who have not experienced a war zone, I know I have not myself, it can be hard to imagine these things. But keep in mind those people that you do know. In my case, my father was a Vietnam veteran, is a Vietnam veteran, has never really recovered. Most of my family has been in some war or another or works for the Department of Defense. All of them face struggles if they saw wartime. And if you did not yourself experience war, you can think of people that you know who have struggled in the face of returning to a very different world, very different people than when they left. So what causes moral injury? The first thing to note is that there is a different moral code in the military than there exists in our civilian world. Our veterans live within two moral systems. Something that can feel right at the time while serving in the military, once returning under civilian moral rules, can seem inappropriate and puts a person inherently in conflict with themselves. So for example, we generally say it's not a good idea to kill people, right? Anybody disagree with me on that? Hope not. But in wartime, it is considered morally acceptable. But when the war's done, a person may still face the reality that they're not sure that was morally appropriate in the first place. The moral codes are drilled into our soldiers from boot camp on, and they live with the certainty of those moral values, but those moral values do not translate into civilian life. Another example of how things occur is around what's called reflexive fire training. In Vietnam, the rate of hitting a person was 72%. If a person fired their gun, it would hit 72% of the time. And this was considered relatively low. So in the 1970s, a form of training was given to our soldiers called reflexive fire training, which essentially takes the soldier's capacity to be able to know that they're shooting away from them. Someone says fire, and they do it without thinking. The advantage to this method is that the shot ratio is 96%. I want you to hear that, 72 to 96%. Drastically improves it. But it often can mean that a soldier doesn't know that they've shot someone until after they've shot someone. One officer put it this way. At one point in his tour, Camilo's squad faced a crowd of protesters. Taking shelter in a building, Camilo held a position on the roof with others in his squad. He had his gun sights on an adolescent young man who appeared to have a grenade in his hand. Camilo was ordered to shoot. He had no awareness of firing, but when he took shelter in a closet by himself and examined his gun magazine, he counted 11 bullets missing. He still has no memory of shooting. All he remembers is the young man standing and then lying dead in a pool of blood in the dirt. He was appalled that his ability to decide what to do had been taken away by his training. Many veterans express shame or guilt over the way they respond to their own training and what that has led them to do. This, again, goes not to whether they were morally or just in doing so, because they may have been. This is about how they think and feel about it later. So we're not in a place of judging folks. We're talking about what a person is doing for themselves as a veteran after they experience these things. The next thing is dehumanization of the enemy. We hear this a lot of rhetoric, particularly in demeaning people who are Muslim and those kinds of things. And in war, it is very common to treat those who are the enemy as animals or something not human in order to be able to fight. And there's often a struggle with reconciling that later. You can think of the many stories of veterans, Vietnam veterans, going back to Vietnam and seeing the human side of the people they once thought of as enemy and as inhumane. Of course, there's the natural reality of killing. Is killing right or wrong? Oftentimes after war, veterans struggle with that question. One of the biggest ones is survivor guilt. And this has to do with, did I do the right thing? Why am I living and my buddies are not? This often faces folks who are struggling with where is God in their lives? Where was God in that moment? Were they really worthy of living and those others not? There's some really difficult and messy ethical questions when it comes to the reality of losing those you trust beyond all things. The natural reality of grief. A major factor is encountering and handling human remains. Many people who handle the human remains of enemies and colleagues find that they struggle with how they treated those bodies or what they did to help make those bodies come to that point in the end. Of course, we are well aware of the torture and atrocities that have occurred in many of the facilities, such as Guantanamo. And you can hear more about the struggles with that by looking at Chaplain Cynthia Kane's work. She is a Unitarian Universalist chaplain who served in Guantanamo and can talk about some of the moral struggles that veterans face there. Betrayal by an authority, feeling like their commanders did not make the best call or did not look out for the veteran in a given situation. And that sense of betrayal can lead to an ethical questioning of themselves. Do they really, if they can't trust that person, can they trust anybody? And finally, doubt about the mission or about the goals of the mission. Many veterans return realizing that they didn't support what was going on in Iraq even though they fought. And though they support their military and they support their colleagues, they struggle with their own questioning about whether what they did as a participant was morally appropriate or right. There are many and sundry ways in which people can experience moral injury. And again, that's that basic foundation of, did I live by my own best standards? Or the core of it, am I a good human being? I think every one of us here has had a moment in our lives when we've asked the question, am I a good human being? One of the questions that I hold on to, and I know I reference Battlestar Galactica a lot, but it's one of my favorites. There's a question that the commander of the military asks in the very first miniseries of the show. He says, humanity never questioned whether it deserved to live, whether it deserved to survive. Our veterans are often forced into situations that are the worst that humanity has to offer, and are placed in close position to that question. Do I, as a human being, deserve to live? Do we, as human beings, deserve to live? Now, there's been a debate within the military community over what to call this and what this means. Some chaplains hear the language moral injury, and they think this is an accusation against the military in some form, and different generals and other folks. And yet, there are other generals and chaplains who understand that this is not a question of whether what the military is doing is right or wrong, but about people's own personal struggle with their own faith, with their own knowledge of how the world is and who they are in it. It is extremely personal, and it can be healed, given the space. And so we just need to make it. So there are more and more conferences and conversations and chaplain trainings around moral injury to support our veterans. But the truth is, a heart of the work is within the congregations and within the communities that our veterans live in. As a Unitarian Universalist, I have served in three congregations where at least a third of the congregation served actively in the military. It is very common for Unitarian Universalists to serve because we tend to stand high on our values. It's heartening for me to know that there are liberal religious people serving in our military. It does make it better. And so this is something that we face as a community. How do we support and help people who are struggling with this loss? One of the simple realities is that we train our military when they go into boot camp into those new ethical standards that exist for the military, but we do nothing at the end of their service to help them change back into that civilian formation. There's some work we can do with that to help our veterans with that. In order to heal, the first thing is that people need to be able to talk about what really happened. Too often when a veteran shares real life experiences, it becomes sort of like television to the people who are listening. They treat it as something awe-inspiring and wow, tell me more, and it's almost so disconnecting, that veterans just shut down and they only talk to other veterans. What is important is for people to find ways of expressing and talk about what happened, from writing poetry and music to integrating their own story into their lives through sharing it with others. The second thing is reconnection, and this is perhaps the most difficult thing that our veterans face. Oftentimes they're estranged from those around them because their experiences are so different that it's hard to communicate that change. We can do much more. Veteran support systems have certainly helped. Certainly service animals and doing work around animal support and care has helped. And community service has been a particular way, because not only can a veteran find a place to be able to give back to their community, they find that the skills that they learned in the military are often particularly attuned to community service. And if they are feeling guilt around something that they have done in service, this is a way to atone and to give back. It's a way to heal and repair what has been done. The thing that we are really missing in this day and age are long-term support systems. And I'm happy to hear that Congress finally, you know, now that the Republicans can claim credit or however you want to understand it, but they did finally vote on something real and passed money to help long-term mental health care and suicide prevention in veterans, and that's a massive step forward. Yes. I think in particular, yeah, religious communities can do a lot to assist with this as well. Giving space for people to be able to talk or dialogue with someone who has a sense of empathy and caring, and is in it to listen and not to respond. Support groups can accomplish this. Well-trained pastoral care associates can accomplish this. Of course, ministers and folks who are in lay leadership can accomplish this. Anyone really can, if you understand that in listening to someone's story, you let it be their own. Not ask too many questions and just let them share it. I think all of us have experienced those moments when we shared something deeply personal and felt the relief of someone who was listening without the need to respond. It does a lot. Creating a space and a language and a ritual for reparation and forgiveness. Unitarian Universalists, we're not big on that whole confession thing, but we do understand the need for forgiveness and for repair. And when we're talking about moral injury, we're talking about repair of the soul. And by soul, I mean that sense of ultimacy within oneself. How do we help that person heal? John Trudell once wrote, "The heart doesn't hurt anymore, but the soul does." Maybe that's what souls are for. A pain that goes beyond heartbreak into an all-encompassing sense of brokenness. We can provide ritual, and we can provide paths for healing and forgiveness for the person who is morally injured. We can create opportunities for connection. And this congregation loves community. They do. I love seeing it. I think we can do better at being welcoming to the stranger. I don't think we do quite as well as we could with welcoming people who are not from around here, so to speak. And I think that we could do better in just letting people's ideas and values be their own. As Unitarian Universalists, we tend to like debate. And this is not a place for debate or opinion. This is a place for presence. The other thing that needs to happen is the soldier needs to be able to reconstruct their world. Create a new understanding of their own moral order. As Gabriella Latini wrote, many veterans let their conscience and their guilt do quiet battle for years. And while they may not hear the shouting, they can feel the turmoil in their guts. The only way, so far as I can tell, to stop the incessant quarrel is to own the responsibility. If I own it, then I can disown it. That is the only way to truly unload my pack. And so for our soldiers, unloading their moral rucks, so to speak, being able to take responsibility to know something that happened, and by owning it, they can let it go. We create possibility for healing. Spiritual practices and meditations that allow for us to own and let go are key ways that we can provide that support. allowing for a system of meaning where personal life fits, where the whole of a person, not just having military life be a military life and somehow my life is left there, but having that life be a part of one's wholeness significantly matters. Joining and not withdrawing. And if you see a veteran withdrawing, probably they need another veteran to come and chat with them. Participating in meaning making in a midst of moral ambiguity and difficult choices. What we notice is that in fundamentalist religions, there tends to be a higher evidence of suicide rates, because there is a feeling that God is more unforgiving, or that they cannot be forgiven within that current culture. But the truth is, in Unitarian Universalism, we tend to stay surface. And more opportunities to go deeper into spiritual questions gives folks the tools to navigate moral ambiguity. And not in some intellectual, let's, you know, fight it out until we get down to the base intellectual thing, but really going deep into how we feel and what we think and how we are with how our spiritual lives are, how our moral lives are. We need to be that trustworthy listener. Again, not looking to judge or to reply, but just to be present and to hold on to confidence. So civilians, regardless of their opinion, are typically not present for troops when they return. Whether they are for war or against war, they tend to not be present for our soldiers, so that when our soldiers return, they don't have a place within civilian life. And so asking questions about violence in society, about questions when we need to go to war, are important. But it is also important to say, what is our role and responsibility to those who choose to serve and their care in the long run, no matter what our opinions may be? Not because of our opinion of a war, but because as Unitarian Universalists, we believe that people matter, and then our connection and our support of them is above everything else. In other words, we say yes to life when in many other religions might say no. In the struggle for truth and meaning after war, the surest testimonies to the intractable presence of soul, of moral conscience, are those who rediscover it and struggle to repair it after the worst thing ever devised by human beings to destroy it. The hard-won victories of self-possession, such as the decision to go to prison rather than return to war, the fleeting moments of self-disclosure to friends, the reawakening of a sense of purpose, these gradual signs of recovery born of honesty, patient listening, and personal courage, are not achieved by putting the ward behind you and moving on. Easy to discourage, difficult to hold. These precious life-sustaining insights and inclinations become eventually the small gifts of spirit that begin to breathe life back into the soul shattered by war. And thus, the journey begins. And so, I invite you to consider one person in your life who's been impacted by war. And ask yourself, have you been truly present to that person without judgment? How have you helped them be a civilian again? Whether they were in war 50 years ago or yesterday. Recovery from moral injury is a lifelong process. And it can't be done in a vacuum. It requires every person sitting here. And so at this time, I invite those who would like to come forward and light a candle here on our altar in memory of someone they know to be recovering from moral injury or from struggles from war. light one more candle for those named and unnamed, those known and unknown. So as we go forth this day, we remember those who have suffered at the hands of the worst humanity has to offer. And through their courage and their strength, even amidst their fear and anger and pain, have survived and said yes to life again and again. For those who need forgiveness, know that you have it. And know that you are not alone. May it be so.